Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, July 8th. I'm your host, Magnus Teeble, and joining me on the program today again is...
Peter R.H. after 2 weeks.
And we're happy to be here. We have some interesting stuff for you. Some reports on new Indigenous treaties signed here in B.C., the first time in more than a decade that Indigenous nations have... reached an agreement with the BC government, treaty agreements. So that's big news. We have some report on the Wet'suwet'en chief who is will be going to jail for the blockades of the pipeline across BC. And Peter's going to talk about Robert.
I've been a change of plan because
okay.
What I was doing was I'm going to do more study for the. The Robert Kennedy Jr. book.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to study a bit more. Actually, what I'm going to bring up
that was the Robert Kennedy book about
Robert Kennedy Jr.
about,
book.
about Fauci,
and I yeah. I want to do a bit more background on it, even though I had 2 weeks, mind you. No, it's a bit more I want to do.
Complicated topic.
Well, yeah, it's because I'm going by a website. It's called Debunk the Funk. And he is someone who is for the COVID vaccine, and he's trying to have these reasons why all these other reasons are invalid. And it took—I don't know—I wanted to do both sides of the issue, and it got a bit complicated. But actually, we had the Joe Biden debate, and what's interesting is that there's been two times in American history where a president was kind of incapacitated. One was Wilson. He had a stroke in 1919.
Right.
And actually his second wife, because he was a widower, was – but they argue he was – she was really the president in 1920.
Right, she's basically acting in his stead.
But he didn't want to run again.
Yeah.
Franklin Roosevelt actually, starting in 1944, was just doing 4 hours in the White House. He had hypertension, a lot of things. In fact, so he was sort of like the... it's interesting because he had the Yalta conferences with Stalin in 45 that were very important. So he was sort of up on his game to a degree for that.
But clearly in failing health because he died shortly later.
He died in March 1945, yes.
Yeah, just before the end of the war in Europe.
He sort of had he was 63 when he died, a lot younger than Joe Biden.
Yeah.
But and his command, I think the thing was Joe Biden. I don't know. It was just how his voice has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to be one issue right now. The other thing I'm going to bring up is there have been two presidents that could have run, but withdraw. That was Harry Truman in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
About April, he said he wouldn't run. And then Lyndon Johnson in 1968. Yeah. But I don't know. Joe wants to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a bit of a problem.
And then there's Ronald Reagan, who many people believe was somewhat incapacitated or, you know, starting to suffer from some sort of cognitive decline late in his presidency.
Well, he was the same age as Joe Biden in 1991. He stopped being president in January 1989.
Yeah.
Joe, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of a hard to know. Like, one way of looking at it, if he was in charge of an actual hardware store, do you think that would not he couldn't be in charge of a hardware store in his capacity. But I know it's hard because everything is very image now.
Yeah.
And people make fun of people more so than they did in the past. I mean, there was always, in fact, but the cartoons on politics predate the comic strips in the actual 19th century. In fact, the imagery of the Republican Party and the being the elephant and the Democrats being the donkey, that's the mid 19th century that was evolved. So, but I think it came more and more kind of was the late night comedy, and even having the, I guess that started in the 1990s, where you had news shows that really were comedy shows. And it's become more and more you make fun of people all the time. The one,
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting the amount of commentary on Joe Biden. And I guess, you know, part of that is because it's part of, you know, Joe Biden's performance, which was not great, you know, plays into the sort of sports analogy of a lot of political reporting, that it's, you know, it's a game and a competition, and that's what matters. But there's not much competition or not much commentary in the fact that I don't think Donald Trump answered one question he was asked during that entire, you know, I mean, it was like he was asked about child care, programs to support better child care for people, and he immediately started talking about the border again, and then they asked him another question, and he started talking about the border and immigrants and illegal immigration again. They asked him another question, and he talked about the border and illegal immigration. And between that and the fact, you know, which is normal for Donald Trump, and the sort of nonstop lies, but that's, you know, I guess that's not a story because he always does that.
Well, you're bringing that this is perhaps the final evolution where it's all style that gets... where the style is what we critique in many ways. I don't know. Like, it's hard to know whether it's just... the thing was that I guess people just saw that Donald Trump could decisively say something, where there seemed to be... I don't know if it's so much proof he has dementia. I don't... Maybe it's just that he's just slowing down. I mean, it's like it wouldn't be... really a question, maybe, if he was could he be a high school English teacher? I don't know. I mean, but it's funny, you know, what was really kind of odd was that he was interviewed by Howard Stern about 2 months ago. And
Joe Biden?
Yes, Joe Biden was on the Howard Stern show, which I really don't like at all. And Howard Stern wore a suit for the occasion.
Right.
And it was interesting seeing that. Could one really see any evidence? But it was like he got softball stuff. Oh, I love you. You're great. And you were a lifeguard in the 1960s. You know, I mean, that sort of... In fact, when they had the... on Friday, they had George... That guy was the long name. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I just heard Stephanopoulos. There's actually another couple of syllables in there, I think.
But I think he was trying to make it as easy as possible for him. He was, trying to make it easy. But it came to a point, well, I'll make it easy for you, but you do have to decisively answer a few things. Whereas with Howard Stern, it was just... I mean, the irony is Howard Stern is the guy who makes fun of people.
Yeah.
It just, you know, does a blatant slur on people. But for Joe Biden, 2 months ago, it was just like, you were a lifeguard. You've saved a life, supposedly. I didn't hear the whole thing because it just was a bit too much to bear. And I don't know, you know, like just, I really didn't see, like, it's interesting, I guess he, but they prepared him for a week on this. Like, then what was he doing presidential? The thing is, right now, we're sort of wondering, well, who's president of the United States right now? A lot of people are saying that.
Well, I imagine it, you know, it seems like he's there. He just had a bad performance, and I don't know, maybe they over-prepared him and over-tired him out. I don't know. It was definitely, you know, I mean, his voice was very scratchy. He was, And he definitely stumbled over a few things. But it's also significant that, you know, Joe Biden has a stutter, which he's sort of through, I think, practice and training has sort of overcome, so you don't really notice it, but he's got a stutter. Mm. You know, and maybe with, you know, some of what, you know, some of that was a bit of that. But there's also a bit where he kind of lost his, you know, train of thought.
I think it also was the, just the voice itself mm-hmm. is faint at times. It's getting faint. And maybe that not an indication of anything yep. other than a faint.
I mean, I think one of the big reasons it becomes a story, though, is, of course, you know, that poor performance played into a story that, you know, the opposition, Republicans and others, have been trying to push about him, that he's not, you know, all there and up to the job. And so, you know, I think the idea was that, from the Democrat side, was that this debate would show Joe Biden to be on top of it, and it kind of showed the opposite. And that played into that story. Whereas if that narrative wasn't already in place, I don't think it would have been as big a story.
Well, he's probably working at the White House longer than Franklin Roosevelt did in 1944 and 45, because they say, oh, he doesn't do anything after 8 o'clock or something, or whatever it is. But I think he's doing more than Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
So the other thing is, I think people are wondering what's his performance right now in the White House until he loses the election, I guess. We've had one. Woodrow Wilson had a stroke, actually, so it isn't the first. I guess we can survive it. It's happened in the. The other thing, I guess, this is sort of a myth about, like, atomic weapons and all that. It's kind of harder than you might think to start off a nuclear war. Mm-hmm. One time on CNN, they were saying, even under Reagan or whatever, to actually start it, you have to go, like, we have a desk here, people can't see it on the radio, but it's like you have to go under this desk, and they had like two keys, you got to do it at the exact same time to do it, to launch something, or the beginning of the launch.
Yeah.
So it's not like a button that's right
no.
there.
Well, my understanding is it took two keys, which were on opposite sides of a room, so one person couldn't do it by themselves. It took at least two people.
Oh, I'm glad you're filling in some information.
Yeah, it took like, because there'd be two people at a missile site, and to launch it, they each had a key, and then they were like, the two key locations were far apart, so that they'd both have to be there and then coordinate their activity to turn it to actually launch a missile, so that, you know, one person going rogue couldn't do it by themselves. They'd need to have the cooperation of the other person. And then, of course, the whole place was quite secure, so you couldn't just break in there.
Well, the other thing is that atomic weaponry was not a concern with Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. They were before the atomic age.
Yeah.
In the case of Franklin Roosevelt, just right before the atomic age.
So the other big story of last week was the Supreme Court decision. You know, basically giving, not just Donald Trump, all future presidents, a huge degree of immunity from any kind of criminal prosecution for anything they do. You know, basically for any official act they do that they're doing in their official capacity, they're completely immune. And for a whole bunch of other acts that are on the periphery, they're presumed to be immune. And then on top of that, and this is the part that seemed weird, they put in restrictions that make it really difficult to investigate any of those sort of edge cases, because you can't use any discussions between the president and any other officials to determine whether an act was an official act in good faith or not, which, you know, according to the legal experts, makes it nearly impossible to prosecute or to bring charges, because you can't really investigate any of that activity.
Well, but that doesn't. One of the odd things about, he was supposed to come get the sentencing, in this month, and now mm-hmm. it's gone to September. But that law won't cover that, because that was done while he was not in office.
Well, oddly, though, the reason I heard on the news was that that sentencing, which was supposed to happen on the 11th, so that's Thursday.
It's going to be September now.
Yeah, that they had to delay it because they needed to examine the ruling as to whether some of the evidence in the case might have been affected or not. That's what I heard.
Now, I like to bring in what my brother and also a Christian radio show that's on every week. It's American News Radio Journal, and it's half hour every week. Kerry Radio has it. It's also on the internet. But they contended, it's a conservative show, they contended it was a lot of exaggeration about this new ruling. They were mainly saying that people are misunderstanding what it really means. It means more like if you do like a, I don't know, you invade Iran, you won't be investigated. I don't, something like that. They were sort of saying a lot of people are propagandizing this ruling, that it's not really much to be concerned about.
I don't know. I've read a lot that says the other way from legal scholars and stuff. I mean, clearly there's spinning on both sides, as there are in every issue, but you know, I've read a lot of stuff in the last week about it from pretty respected sources and people who seem to know what they're talking about. That is pretty significant.
What would be a concern about it from what you've gathered from it? What would be a concern? What would be a...
Well, one of the things is that, you know, a whole class of stuff was considered an official act, including any time when a president talks to one of their officials. That's an official act. So, you know, effectively, they could order somebody to do something, and as long as they don't do it themselves, so they could order, you know, the example they kept using, you know, was they could order SEAL Team 6 to go and execute someone or take out a political rival. And that would be considered an official act, and they would be immune from prosecution.
Well,
now, of course, the people who go and do the act wouldn't be immune from prosecution, but then the president has the power to grant pardons to anyone they want, so they could have someone. And that's an extreme case, but you could also see a situation where, you know, the president, you know, orders the harassment of political rivals, or orders, you know, as in the case of Nixon, you know, a break into, you know, rivals' stuff to places for whatever reason, and they were talking to an official, so that was considered, you know, all that kind of stuff. There. Granted immunity for all those actions, and then they can, if they want, you know, turn around and pardon, you know, people who did it, so that the people who are at threat of prosecution can then be pardoned, and everybody gets off the hook.
Well, the Iran-Contra affair of the 1980s was all over North. How would that play under this regulation, do you feel? Because they were, I mean, that became a contention.
That was a long time ago, so I don't remember enough details to be able to, like, fit it into this new situation. But, you know, I mean, basically, the ruling kind of makes the president above the law.
Well, they sort of got away with it, Iran-Contra. Mm-hmm. Like, Oliver North got a radio show or something. And you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, he did go to jail, though, did he not, for a bit, I think?
Oh.
I can't remember. But, of course, you know, sometimes doing bad things makes you a hero of a certain constituency, and you can really profit off it these days.
Okay, maybe we'll go to a song, and we'll find out.
Okay,
later in the show, whether all what happened to Oliver North. I'll just incidentally say something about that.
Yeah. Anyway, let's turn to some more local stories. In the past, about a week ago, two new treaties have been signed here in British Columbia. between First Nations and the provincial government, part of a very long going and quite a very slow treaty process. The Kitsilas First Nation signed an agreement just over a week ago, and then the next day, the Katsukalam First Nation also signed a treaty, and we have a report about that, which we'll bring you right here.
In Davalawan, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The initialing of the Kitsum-Kalum Treaty on June 25th marks a significant milestone in the relationship between Kitsum-Kalum First Nations, the Government of Canada, and the Government of British Columbia. This treaty, influenced by principles from UNDRIP, focuses on preserving Kitsum-Kalum's culture and spiritual practices while advancing their autonomy. CFNR was on location for the initialing and later spoke with Melissa Quackster, Communications and Community Engagement Consultant.
It's Melissa Quackster. I'm a member of the Comox First Nation, and I work with Kitsum-Kalum as a Communications and Community Engagement Consultant.
Okay, so how will Kitsum-Kalum ensure that the treaty respects and supports the community's cultural traditions, language, and spiritual practices?
Good question. Kitsum-Kalum will support communities, cultural traditions, languages, and spiritual practices through their culture and heritage chapter, which is embedded with the governance chapter. It is also protected in the Kitsum-Kalum Constitution that they will always be able to practice, promote, and preserve their culture, languages, and spiritual practices. And that will happen with the guidance and direction of the Kitsum-Kalum people, hereditary chiefs, and spiritual leaders.
Can you outline Kitsum-Kalum's approach to ensuring fair and equitable representation of all community members in decision-making processes post-treaty?
Absolutely. Kitsum-Kalum will ensure fair and equitable representation of all community members in decision-making processes post-treaty through a forum that we are calling the People's Assembly, the Kitsum-Kalum People's Assembly. So a minimum of once a year, there needs to be an assembly held where the Kitsum-Kalum government needs to present strategic plans, budgets, and any legislative pieces that need to be discussed on the floor. During that time, they will integrate and include feedback on any of these issues from the people. And the way the organization structure will work is, instead of having the council or executive or legislature at the top, it's actually Kitsum-Kalum members at the top, and they direct the government of Kitsum-Kalum. So it's not BC and Canada sort of dictating your leadership anymore. It's now the people who dictate. And if the leadership does not follow the guidance and direction of the people, then that will show in the following elections.
All right. So what opportunities does Kitsum-Kalum foresee for youth involvement and leadership development within the new governance structures established by the treaty?
Kitsum-Kalum foresees youth involvement and leadership and development within the new governance structures established by the treaty through a number of ways. We've discussed having elder representation on committees that inform or provide direction or information to the legislature or the administrative executive folks in the government structure. We have also at this time been, or in the past summer and this upcoming summer, looking at having some summer students take part in the work we do inside in communications and other Kitsum-Kalum work. Other than that, we have our doors always open to youth. We do utilize social media such as Instagram and Facebook, mostly Instagram, to try and entice young people to take a look. It is very hard to connect with youth today, and we need to find their level of understanding. At the end of the day, all of this is for them.
What are the provisions in the treaty that support Kitsum Kalum's aspirations for self-governance and autonomy over local affairs?
Provisions in the treaty that support Kitsum Kalum's aspirations for self-government and autonomy, it's spelled out in the governance chapters, several governance chapters that speak to this, as well as there are, I would say, what it comes down to is Kitsum Kalum, under the treaty, becomes a third order of government, along with BC and Canada. They are more than a municipality, have more powers and more authority. However, that doesn't give Kitsum Kalum any authority over local governments, but an equal standing where they can work together for the betterment of all everybody who lives in the Terrace area and the Kitsum Kalum territory.
So how has Kitsum Kalum engaged with local municipalities and regional governments to ensure alignment and cooperation on shared priorities post-treaty?
Kitsum Kalum has engaged with local municipalities and regional governments over the last several years. We have had representatives from the regions or at the City of Terrace sitting at the treaty table over several years, so they have been sort of a part of it and at a bit of a liaise with the rest of the local government there. And they have been in support, and over the past few years, as Kitsum Kalum and the local governments have been getting to know each other, the relationship has been growing stronger. In addition, BC and Canada absolutely have a obligation and a duty to consult with their local governments as well. And Kitsum Kalum has been participating as part of the team in those consultations with local government to ensure that they are aware of the process and where we're going, and answering any other questions.
And then the last question, what measures are in place within the treaty to enhance healthcare, education, social services for Kitsum Kalum members, particularly vulnerable populations?
Excellent question. So the measures that are in place within the treaty to enhance healthcare, education, and social services for Kitsum Kalum members, including vulnerable populations, include the negotiations around existing programs and services to continue to start. Over time, as Kitsum Kalum builds wealth, they will be able to add in and build programs and services for both folks who live within the territory and outside the territory to try and create equity amongst all the people and a higher quality of life for Kitsum Kalum members. To do that, we have ensured that all those programs and services that are in place now will continue and be enhanced in certain areas. In addition to that, modern treaty nations that are already in existence are in a separate set of negotiations to increase the programs and services within their own nations. When those negotiations are completed, we will be able to incorporate them into the Kitsum Kalum treaty, where that will increase the amount for programs and services for Kitsum Kalum people over the next several years.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you. This week, at the Smithers Courthouse, the Supreme Court of British Columbia convened to deliberate the case of Coastal GasLink Pipeline versus Chief Sahail, also known as Adam Gagnon, on the grounds that Chief Sahail tampered with heavy equipment and blocked access to roads leading to a CGL pipeline job site on Wet'suwet'en territory in October of 2021. The Crown prosecution requested a sentence of jail time due to Chief Sahail's leadership role in the community, which, along with a lack of a guilty plea, according to the prosecution, showed a strong instance of the case of distress and deterrence, even though he's a 68-year-old first-time offender and since the breach of the court order has not been a repeat offender. The principles of GLADU were enacted in this case, which is a sentencing principle that recognizes that Indigenous peoples face racism and systemic discrimination in and out of the criminal law system, and it attempts to deal with the crisis of overrepresentation and inequities of Aboriginal peoples in custody. GLADU instructs judges when sentencing or setting bail to consider, quote, all available sanctions other than imprisonment that are reasonable in the circumstances, with particular attention to the circumstances of Aboriginal